Hello, everybody, and welcome to 3-Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
I'm Lee White.
And I'm Will Terry. And all three of us are professional illustrators and have worked for just about every major publisher in the business. We've all been working for about the last 25 years, and together we have somewhere around 100 books that we've published, and we've all taught illustration at universities.
Each week, we have a different topic that we try to tackle. We argue, we scrap, and then we all hug each week. But every time, you're going to learn something new.
I don't want to hug it out.
So we have a little bit of follow-up from our How to Launch a Book episode. And Will, do you want to read to us? Will, tell us who you got an email from, and you want to read the email?
Yeah. So we were talking about... I had mentioned the story from Brian Lees on the show, and apparently he was listening. And so he gave us a little follow-up that we thought would be kind of fun to read. And so he says, "Hey, well, just listening to your podcast now, geez, suddenly I feel all famous. Thanks a lot for all the attention. I was going to ask who the mutual friend was, but I see from this thread it must have been Ken Dabrowski. He's right. And thanks for pronouncing my last name right. Few people do. I didn't see a place to comment on the blog. Just wanted to say I can't take all of the credit you gave me. My wife, who spent 25 years in corporate PR, came up with a bunch of the ideas, and I was the implementer with NPR. We had already decided to go all in with promoting Bats at the Beach and had booked a bunch of events at coastal Maine bookstores. Whoever said creating a tax-deductible vacation was right. Wasn't that you, Lee?
That was me.
Houghton Mifflin actually got the book into the hands of Daniel Pinkwater, who independently decided to review it on Weekend Edition with Scott Simon. We honestly thought when we were told it was going to be on the show that it was going to be a simple mention of on the summer kids books list. But the two read the entire damn thing. June 24th, 2006, 9:43 a.m. Eastern Time, but who's counting? On the air. Within an hour, it was number two on Amazon, all books. Absolutely mind-blowing. But that buzz made all of our summer events great. We, too, carried boxes of books with us and gave them to our bookseller friends. When their copies ran out, we asked them to reorder books and have them sent to our house so that those books counted as regular sales and not as sold to author copies. It was heady and amazing. Beach was my 18th illustrated book, but the first that anyone outside of reviewers had ever seemed to notice. What is true is that while I was sitting on a chair in a parking space in front of the bookstore, Laura, my wife, would be working the passing gathering groups, telling them that this is a New York Times bestselling author, and the crowd brings an even greater crowd. I wonder what they would have done if they knew we were married. So this was a case of planning marketing well in advance of publication, as y'all were discussing, and a fantastic dose of good luck. But if you're not prepared, you can't take advantage of those lightning strikes when they happen. Thanks again. I appreciate the mention very much. Brian.
Well, that was cool.
That was very cool.
Setting the record straight, but also sort of backing up the whole message and the gist of that episode.
Well, it's hard to get all the details exactly right, but if you watch that episode, I think we hit it pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Cool.
Not bad.
It's a great story. I love creative marketing stories.
Yeah, me too.
So inspiring.
Me too. One of my favorites is the Casey Neistat Nike commercial that he made, mm-hmm. where he basically, in the video, he says, "Nike gave us a budget to make a video. We decided to spend it all on traveling around the world. And here's our video." And they just recorded the whole thing. And that video went viral. It's millions and millions and millions of views. And it did way more than any sort of planned, like, whatever he could have done with the money, mm-hmm. you know, to make a commercial. So think outside the box. Think how you can best leverage your strengths and your abilities to promote your stuff. Okay, so this is our 50th episode. Can you guys believe that?
Golly, that's a lot.
Wow,
50 episodes. We've stuck with it. I will
you say that like you're surprised.
Well, you know how these things go. I'll be really, though, a cause for true celebration will be our 100th episode. Because I feel like then then we'll have we'll have passed into the triple digits, and that's charted territory that few enter in with podcasts.
I disagree. So,
is there a significant fall off after a certain rate?
You just go search for podcasts and see how many episodes they have, and if it's a podcast that's tracking on iTunes, most of them are consistently posting, but in the percentage of podcasts that are out there, the majority of them are I don't want to say failed podcasts, but retired podcasts or mm-hmm. paused podcasts, whatever.
Right. So, well, hey, let me put out a call for action for you guys. We love to hear from you guys, not only the reviews, which are funny when you're critiquing us, but we love to hear the praise as well. But I'd love to hear some show ideas. We hope we're bringing important content, and we think we're bringing important content to the illustration community. But what do you guys think? Is there some topic that we need to hit that we haven't hit? And what would you guys like to hear? I'd love to hear from our viewers.
Yes, that's a good ask, I believe. So with this 50th episode, this is Will's taking the charge of this episode. And what do you want to talk about today, Will?
Okay, so today's topic is 10 lessons we learned from starting svslearn.com. And we actually recorded this podcast before, as you guys may remember, since you were there. But we didn't like how it went because we didn't relate it to how it could help others. It was more of like a history of SVS Learn. So,
yeah, because Will got an email, a question that just was like, wasn't it like, how'd you guys even start SVS Learn?
Yeah,
like,
how'd you ever even start?
So the idea was, let's just tell the story of it. But at the end of the episode, we were like, it's a little too... we were a little too into ourselves, I guess. I don't.
That question was by Tom, by the way. So, Tom, if you're listening, thank you for the question. But we kind of changed it, and rather be, self-serving, we kind of decided that we wanted to re-record and make it so that if you're trying to start any kind of a business or a company that's related to art, that maybe our mistakes or the lessons that we've learned can maybe help you. So that's kind of how we're approaching this. And we have, it looks like we might have 10 or 12.
This is going to be a five-hour
podcast. We'll see how many we get through. So number one, let's start there. And this was, we all kind of gave input on this. And this was kind of Lee's. So Lee's first one was start with a minimal viable product. What do you mean by that, Lee?
Well, I just mean that everything doesn't have to be absolutely perfect when you start selling something. And a lot of people kind of sabotage themselves thinking that all things are going to be up and running and everything's got to be nailed down before you open your doors or launch your print or start your class or whatever you're going to do. We were far from perfect at SVS. We had a ragtag group of classes that you guys had already started, and I kind of got brought on. And I mean, it definitely wasn't an organized place, but there was still a product, and we still were, able to push it out in its rough form and then start the process of refining and building from there.
Yeah. Didn't Jake say something like finish not perfect? Have you ever said
that? I've said that before, and the minimum viable product was mine, not Lee's.
Oh, was it? Oh, okay.
I can't believe Lee was like, yeah, yes. Let me talk all about this lesson.
I didn't even have that planned. I just went with that. Like it was
Lee,
my idea.
Lee seems like he always has the smarter things to say, so I just assumed
it's true. It's true.
Will says, send me three of your lessons you learned from starting SVS. Immediately I send over my three lessons, and Lee,
you did.
Lee takes them for his own. Okay.
I did. I copied and pasted the exact list that Jake sent.
Oh, you know what's
said,
funny? Here's mine. I thought it was the other way around, honestly. I thought, I remember.
Who knows who was first? I can't even remember.
I was driving, and so when I saw that,
I can't even remember who was first. It could have been me. It could have been Jake. I don't know who was first.
This is ridiculous. Okay, minimum viable product. Here's what I meant when I said that. Here's what it is. This actually comes from a book called The Lean Startup. And the guy who wrote the book wasn't the originator of this, but he talked about it. And he gives this great example in this book. And this is, he says, you want, so the idea is you want to transport a person from A to B, from point A to point B, right? And so you have this great idea of a car. I know, I'm going to build a car. It's going to have all these features. And so you get to work on it and you start building the wheel and you make that wheel perfect and you release it to the public. And the public's like, what do I do with the wheel? And then you're like, okay, well, hold on. And so then you create an engine. You're like, well, now I got an engine. Okay, yeah, but I need four more wheels. I can't get this thing to work, right? And so like that's how some companies try to build out what they're doing. And even creatives try to do that with the projects that they're working on is making it piecemeal. And the point of the lean startup is you make the minimum viable thing that can accomplish the task. And so if you want to get from point A to point B and you not have to walk, the minimum viable product there would be a skateboard. It's just a board with four wheels on it. And then once you get that to work and people are liking it and you're getting feedback, then you can add handlebars to it. And then you could switch out the wheels for bigger wheels and turn it into a bicycle. And then you can add an engine to the bicycle and turn it into a motorcycle. And then you can double the motorcycle and put a hood on it and make it a car. And then you've got a car. And all along the way, your customers are getting served. And so that's what I was meaning there. We had this idea for SVSlearn.com. We wanted it to be this big thing where people could come and learn how to be amazing illustrators. But instead of building it out from the beginning as being this big thing and just doing it piecemeal, we started by making one class that could serve people well, and that was how to illustrate children's books. And it was like our skateboard version. It was the first version, and it had kind of the essential parts of what we needed to get people from point A to point B: a way to sign up, a way to take the class, an outline of the class, a way to go through it and do some assignments. And then once we saw that that worked, we started adding on more features. We built the second class, we built the third class, and kind of grew it out from there. So that's where I was going with minimum viable.
Just
same,
that.
Same.
Wow.
Same thing.
Okay, I like that. That's a good solid start. Thank you, Jake.
You're welcome. I'm here if you guys need me. Here okay. all day.
Okay. But I should add that my fake response is actually a real response too, that don't let the fear of perfection stop you from doing something. There's a lot of people that think it all has to be all figured out and they never launch.
Yeah.
And there's the opposite side of that too, where you launch too quick. And that's something that, how do you know when you're ready to launch? I mean, is there some criteria? That was my question with that.
I can answer that
point.
And yeah. I think it comes from launching small projects, launching slightly bigger projects, launching slightly bigger and bigger and bigger to where you've done it enough to where you know that you're ready.
So you don't want to launch a big concert with supermodels on an island.
So you're talking about the Fyre Fest?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
If you guys haven't seen that on Netflix, it is quite a show.
And a follow-up to that is TanaCon on YouTube. Look that one up.
We'll put this in the show notes. But yeah, the Fyre Festival is some guy who wanted to have a festival on an island and with models and like luxury villas and 70,000 people flying to this unpopulated island.
It's one of the best documentaries I've seen recently.
It is such a disaster.
FYRE, Fyre.
Yeah, look it up. But anyway, they went too big and didn't have any proof of concept or anything. And they got burned. The fire got burned.
Overestimating one's abilities. Okay, number two, don't reinvent software that's already been created and available. So one of the things that we did when we first started was we knew we needed a website, and this was about a year and a half, 2 years in. And so we approached a software developer who was very capable and who kind of had even advised us, hey, there might be some software already out there, but I can definitely create custom software for you. So he did. And he was building the site for about a year and a half. Wasn't it about a year and a half?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it ended up costing us around $40,000 And as soon as we were done and Lee White joined us, Lee starts poking around the internet and he's like, you know, our site sucks compared to what's out there. And there's like other services that you can pay, that you can buy or rent. And he found the service that we're currently using.
And we had to piecemeal it together. We had to Frankenstein it. It wasn't perfect. And I don't think any scenario is going to be exactly what you need. But we Frankensteined a couple of different companies' offerings together to make something pretty robust, I think.
So thanks, Lee.
Yeah, thanks, Lee.
Hey,
can I here to help. can I counter that? Can I disagree with that note?
Ooh, an argument. All right, let's go. Hold on.
He's got his mouth guard in.
Let's go.
Some punches.
Let's go.
So do you remember when we sat down and had lunch with Sahil? And so Sahil is the guy who started Gumroad.
Yeah.
And he's just this brilliant guy who really knows what he's doing. And he was like one of the early people at Pinterest, and he left that to start his own thing called Gumroad. And so he was living in Provo for a little while, and we thought we'd kind of take advantage of that and pick his brain and kind of see what we're doing as SVS. And his advice was own your platform. Mm-hmm. He's like, yes, it's fine to like Frankenstein a website together and use all these options, but at the end of the day, you're going to want to own everything that you are using because you have full control over it. And so I think that should be something we look at down the line, is how we can transition into that. And his whole thing too, I follow him on Twitter. He's great. He's lots of good advice. His whole thing is like, everyone has the tools and the resources available to them to become a programmer. And there's things you can do with just the things that you can start building and creating with just the basic understanding of programming as it's taught now. And he's like, there's no excuse for people to not learn how to do some of the things that you need to do for your business as far as programming.
I'm going to counter that because coding sucks.
I was going to follow up that. I also think you should play to your strengths, but maybe there is a point here, and we've talked about this before too, about building out, hiring on a developer at some point to start working these pieces together so it's a little bit more seamless.
Because we have a huge wish list. We have a big wish list of things that our site doesn't allow us to do right now. Mm-hmm. So that's what you're talking about.
Yep.
Yeah. I like the option of where we need to make this a usable point for the audience, and so we don't need to get too much in the weeds with our company specifically, but I like the option of taking the things that are available and then massaging them rather than starting from scratch, because that's an expensive option. And I'll give you just a real quick example. I did a deep dive the past 2 months of I'm having a couple of shows coming up, and framing is really expensive. I've talked about it a little bit on this podcast, and up to the point where I was going to make my frames. Making my frames is the absolute cheapest option. But is it the best option? No, it's horrible because it takes too long. And I found a service that's almost as cheap as me making it, and they make beautiful frames. And so, of course, I'm going to go with that over the cheapest option. So you just got to find your resources and a cost labor balance.
At the end of the day, you own those frames. So Jake is right.
No, we still own all the content. Just the platform is not ours. But I don't want to own the platform, because the second that the internet changes – And the technology changes, some weird thing happens, and then all of a sudden, the site that is all that we custom built is now obsolete. Mm.
So, you have to when it goes from HTML4 to HTML5, you have to adjust everything to take advantage of all that.
And that's expensive. I mean, some companies, like if you're a huge company, but the people that this podcast is going out to is going to probably be either individual artists or maybe two or three people together like us. I don't know.
I think the bottom line is if we become large enough, we will have to build out our own. There's no question. It's to get what we want.
Yeah.
Or we've talked to a developer who said they can work within the framework of the service, you know, the SaaS that we have, the software as a service, that they can incorporate that into, I don't even know how to describe it, but basically the development that they're doing and eventually phase that out over time is a possibility.
Yeah.
But it is very expensive.
All right. We're getting lost in the weeds with
okay. All right. Number three.
It's turned into a meeting. At some point, it stopped being a podcast and started being a meeting.
This was this number three is mine, and I'm very proud of this one. So I'm going to read it clearly. I don't want you guys to interrupt me.
This one's me and Will's.
This better be no, good.
It's not. It's just mine. Each partner in a partnership must bring a different essential, a set of, no, see, I can't even read it. Must bring different essential skills and abilities. Mm. And that, and I've seen partnerships before, and I've been in partnerships before where one or more people are carrying, you know, 75 to 80% of the workload. And then that will always create a situation where the people carrying the heavy burden will say, wait, why did we partner with this other person who's mm-hmm. kind of getting carried along?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So thanks a lot for carrying me, you guys. I really appreciate it.
No, I mean, I think that's one of the unique things about our little grouping here is we each do really fill in where the other person falls off. And mm-hmm. it seems pretty equal, mm-hmm. but I do want to even back up and recommend that if you are a listener out there and you're thinking about starting a business, it's way more fun to do it with somebody else. And it's way harder to do it just by yourself, even though the profits mm-hmm. are more and all that stuff. I've seen even some of my students when they're, you know, I recommend students do art fairs and comic cons and stuff and sell prints. I've seen, you know, groups of them go together and buy tables together. And it becomes this, you know, community building thing and friendship building thing. And then they share the load. They split the cost of paper and all that stuff. So, you know, starting something with a group of people is a lot of fun. And mm-hmm. I would highly recommend it. Mm-hmm. That's actually how I joined us to weave SVS into this whole thing. That's how we all got, Jake and Will already had classes going. And I had been laid off from the Art Institute of Portland along with like 800 other people. And I was like, I know I want to do online classes, but I don't want to do this by myself. I just knew it from the get-go. So I just did mm-hmm. a straight Google and then found Will's contact, sent him a thing saying, hey, I'd like to teach a class. You got room. And then
you threatened us.
I did. I held him hostage.
he showed us this beautiful studio that he had built in his backyard. A really nice studio.
Yeah, custom studio.
I could partner with you guys, but if you don't want to, that's fine because I've got this beautiful studio and I'm just going to be your competition.
I'll just go against you.
Now, why did you contact Will and not me?
It was whoever's contact was on the thing. It wasn't even Will. It was like contact okay. here. So anyway, I knew that I wanted to be with people and it was just kind of serendipity from there. They had a lecture that they were doing that weekend with SCBWI and there was like 100 people were doing this online crit or they were doing an online crit and invited me to join in. And then the banter like this started immediately. So,
but let me correct you a little bit, Lee. You did send it to both Jake and I ignored it. Because I specifically remember,
ouch!
I was just no, I didn't even open it. I didn't even see it. I had my inbox was kind of full, and Jake was like, "Did you see this letter from Lee White?" I'm like, "No," and he goes, "You should look at it. It's really cool." And
oh yeah,
yeah, and because he said your work was really good, I think I saw the subject heading, and I was like, you know how it is when I don't know, we just always underestimate. People's abilities as a natural way. I think we're protecting ourselves from being let down.
Well, when you get a lot of emails too that say the same thing, there's an expectation that starts to happen.
Right. And an interesting anecdote to that is that when I saw your work, immediately I recognized it because I was using it in my classes to teach with at UBU. Mm-hmm. I was using it as good examples of how to design and everything. And so I'm like, oh my gosh, this guy's, you know, wants to teach with us. And your style going, you know, speaking to the partnership, totally different than Jake's and I, and you kind of rounded us out and gave us legitimacy in the more, how would you describe your work?
I'd say design based,
a little more primitive.
Yeah.
You trick people into thinking that they could do what you're doing. I think, you
that's
know,
a good,
like,
good way of putting it.
Like I could do that. And then they can't. So yeah. Okay. Anything more on that, you guys?
Nope, that's good. I think that one was mine too, as well. But
keep mine as well.
Okay, number four. Know/learn your audience.
Mm. Yep.
So is that yours, Lee?
Yeah, but what's our, now you hit our list, so I don't know what our example was.
Oh, sorry, you're not looking at it. You put an example in here. Live classes don't work for a global audience.
Oh, yeah. So as we've, we started by saying, hey, let's launch some online classes. Well, then that's the first iteration of something. And then all of a sudden you realize, oh, the whole world is on. I wanted to launch a live version. We were doing videos that you download, and I wanted to do a live version of it where everybody meets at the same time. Well, if the world is your classroom, the world is not on the same time zone. And that kind of hit us right in the face. We sold all these seats, and it's like, oh my gosh, how do we come together all at the same time? And so, yeah. So you start the business like our number one point was, maybe it's not all fleshed out. And then you just have to really ramp up and learn, listen to your customers and see where the problems are. And then you got to start kind of, duct taping the holes in the dam, I guess, and try to figure it out. And each version we thought was the perfect version. And then there'd be a new hole that would spring up and be like, mm-hmm. Oh, we got to fill that. And so don't think that it's just going to be easy. You have to kind of look and see how people are using your product. If you're selling something, is there one thing that's selling over something else? And why is that selling? We've had a bunch of talks about curriculum, and we're still trying to listen to our customer to tell us, what are they not getting at normal schools, and what do they need, and what do they want, and trying to predict that, and mm-hmm. It's tough to keep up, but you really have to listen.
It was interesting when we were in some of those early classes, and we thought we had the perfect idea, which was you schedule a time, you have people sign up for a class, they all show up at 7 p.m. because that's a great time for people to do it after work, right? Now, we knew we were global in some ways, and we thought, well, we'll have a few people joining us from overseas. And I think there was one of those early classes where there were 7 or 8 domestic students from the U.S., and then everyone else was in a different country. We had 2 or 3 people from Australia. We had people in Belgium. We had people in England. We had people in Switzerland and someone in Mexico. And we were like, wait a minute, what time is it over there? And they were coming back with, it's 3 a.m, it's 4 a.m. And I'm like, how can you pay attention at 4 a.m. when you've, mm-hmm. had to get up at 3 to get ready? So we decided that was, not working. And so you have to be adaptable.
I think the other takeaway from this too is, if you're creating something for a fan base, whether it's an illustration, illustrated book, or a graphic novel, or whatever it is that you're working on, if a single fan emails you and says, "Listen, you need to fix this, this, and this. I didn't like this character. This needs to be changed." They're wrong. But if the majority of your fans aren't buying the thing, or are you're getting low reviews on it, then they're almost always right. Mm-hmm. So it's like you listen to the group. You don't listen to the individual, because the group has a way of I guess telling you what things you need to fix, what things you need to change. The individual, it's just up to their unique perspective and their taste. And then you're creating for that one person instead of following your own muse, but also doing what works for the majority.
Mm-hmm. I want to add a little piece here, a little question to you guys, and it's just something that I've noticed. It's a little bit off topic, but I guess goes into knowing your audience as well. I've noticed that because the world is getting smaller in terms of commerce and ordering online and everything's so fast now, do you guys, either through SVS or your own personal businesses, ever fight with your customers sort of expecting you to behave like an Amazon? I mean, I'm just a person here trying to illustrate. Somebody orders a print, I try to get it in the mail as fast as I can. Sometimes that's that day. Sometimes it's like 4 days later because I'm in the middle of something else,
right.
And they're mad at me. Mm-hmm. And so are you guys fighting that a little bit too? And how do you deal with that?
Go ahead, Jake.
Well, yeah, I get that from time to time. And my response is always, listen, I'm not Amazon. I don't actually have Prime vans driving around neighborhoods. I can't afford that.
You don't have drones dropping your prints off.
So you're just going to have to deal with it. You're buying a semi-handcrafted product from an artisan. So you're going to have to, you know, part of the price you pay for that is you're going to have to wait for me to ship it out.
Yeah. And that's been a problem with SVS too, is we say, hey, we're going to launch a new class and all intents and purposes, we're going to launch it on this day. And all of a sudden it's, you know, a week later. Yeah.
I've noticed too, that you have your fans that know who you are and have followed you on social media, and maybe they've met you, and they tend to give you a lot of latitude. Whereas someone who has never met you, has just sort of found you, your work, and doesn't know you, the Lee White, the person,
right,
is going to be more cold in the exchange.
Well, yeah, they're the people who compare you to Amazon. Like, hey, I got my detergent that I ordered on Amazon yesterday. Where's the print that I ordered yesterday? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Number five, forums can create a vibrant community. And I put this one on there because we operated for years without any kind of forums or, you know, having anything like that. And as soon as we opened that part of our website up, it was like, I mean, it was so surprising to me how many people can not only contribute on a regular basis, but kind of have taken ownership of svslearn.com. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's there.
Yeah. It's a vibrant community on that forum for sure.
Yeah. And we love that. I mean, it's like it, you know, they help each other. They disseminate information to each other. They police the forums. We don't really have to do much there.
It's pretty great. How do we make that relatable to the audience? Unless they're going to, I mean, does an individual.
Well, being able to talk to your customers never been easier than today with technology. So whatever that is, you know, you see, we were my wife and I were at a restaurant last night, and on the way out, they had a little kiosk where you could, you know, give them feedback. And I mean, we're all looking for feedback. The forums are a lot more than feedback. But it is it's a thing that costs money for us, but it's really worth it because it really helps develop a community around what we're trying to do.
Yeah. And maybe maybe that's a good takeaway, is develop a community around your business.
I think you, if there's whatever you can do to, I think, pull people off of social media and have them communicate directly via, you know, some sort of platform like a forum, mm-hmm. or something a little bit more intimate, what you're going to do is make an overall better experience, because you don't have to fight an algorithm. You don't have to fight, you know, interlopers who aren't
drive-bys,
a part of your community.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Everybody has this common goal, or should. Mm-hmm. And so there's kind of a peer pressure that develops around that to behave and to be helpful and to be positive. And yeah, we've seen that. Okay. Ready for number six?
Let's move on.
Offer a sample or discount of your product.
Okay.
Discuss.
Number seven.
What did we do?
We offered a free trial. So one of the things that we discussed and has been very intentional with SVS is we've never offered a discount on our subscription or on our classes, because we're kind of taking the Apple model, and we know that in retail, once you start the sales, you know, the sale thing, then you're teaching your customers not to ever buy anything at a regular price. So always wait for a sale. Mm-hmm. And that can really be disruptive as far as, you know, trying to get a baseline of influx of customers and things like that. And so if I really feel this way that, you know, if you're going to, no matter what you're selling, you know, you can have a standard deal. Like when I sell at comic conventions, I have a standard deal, but I don't deviate from that. And I don't want to ever hurt my customers by offering a deeper discount and then having someone who paid a higher price feel like, you know, they supported me early on.
Yeah.
And now someone else who didn't have anywhere near as much investment is now getting a better deal, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right. Like there's something, I mean, there is a reward for being an early adopter in that you get this thing before everyone else. And so, but you're also paying a premium for that. Mm-hmm. And then and then later you could offer it for sale, understanding that you got it before them, these people who are getting it on sale. But I think there is training. It, whatever you do, you train people. So you have to have some sort of incentive as to why being an early adopter was such a cool thing versus, you know, just getting it before everyone else, right? Maybe they were part of the creation. They had input on the product. Maybe, you know, the thing you want to avoid is training people that, yes, if you just hang out long enough, you're going to get it cheaper. And then you're forced to always...
and then you make your current stock of people mad, your current customer base mad. And yeah, it's a bad cycle. So to get around that, we came up with the idea of a free trial, like 7 days. And it's not unusual in a school or even app setting, I guess, at this point. It's almost always a free or a light version of something. But it's a good idea. How do you translate that to another business that an illustrator might run? Like, how do you do that with a client base? Or how do you do that with a for sale or items that you actually sell? For us in our print business, we offer free shipping, and that's the kind of discount that we run. And we noticed a huge increase in business when we started offering free shipping, and we just kept the price of the product the same. We didn't try to absorb it or anything. And I think people appreciate a little kickback.
Yeah.
There's that. The other thing I like too is almost like a free sample, like a downloadable PDF or something if you have a book coming out that's 120 pages, you could do a free PDF of 30 pages of it just to get people interested and see if it's something they even like or not. I always would do that in exchange for an email because people, the email is something that typically won't change. It's hard to change your email. I know people have like burner emails or like junk mail emails that they'll exchange for stuff like that. But the exchange there is I'm giving you something free for access to you later on because you've showed interest in something that I'm doing. I think that's all kind of kosher for
yeah, that works. It's a fair trade.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Okay. Number 7, great artists don't always make great teachers. And boy, have we learned this. So we kind of have the five points of a great teacher that we've kind of lived by. And they are, one, that they have mastered their craft. So they really are a great artist. Mm-hmm. But they also have to be good at speaking. In order to teach, you have to use your mouth and talk. And some people are really, 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 really shy. The third one is they have to be proficient at the technology that they're using. We've had some bad experiences there where, you know, the lesson was clouded by the lack of ability on even running the software they were using to teach with. A good web presence is really helpful because if you're trying to promote someone or someone's product online, if they don't show up in a Google search, it makes your job that much harder in marketing them. And probably the most important thing is that they love teaching. And it's surprising how many people they might say they want to teach, mm-hmm. or say that, you know, they're really excited about it. But then when it comes down to teaching, they haven't fallen in love with the process of breaking down concepts to make them explainable. And to me, you can tell when a teacher really loves teaching because they enjoy the hard work behind the scenes before they ever get to the class of preparing their lessons and making them in a digestible way with examples, with diagrams, whatever it takes to break it down. And I can say that for the three of us, we love teaching.
You can always tell. My little hallmark for seeing whether somebody's a good teacher or not is at the end of a demo, are they looking to get a reaction from the student like, wow, you're so great, or wow, I learned a lot? Those are two separate ideas. And that's been the hardest one, because we hire great artists. We know when somebody's a really good artist. The problem is they, instead of teaching, they're doing a demo of how they work, and those teaching and doing a demo of your process is kind of two different things.
Jake and I did a what you just brought to mind was an experience where Jake and I interviewed a certain person on a video, and not for SVS, and the person came on to talk about themselves and say, "Look at me, look how great I am." That was the feeling that I got the whole time. There wasn't any attention really spent to here's what I can give to your listeners for value. It was look at how great I am. And that, that doesn't make for a great teacher. And and it's funny because the views on that video were lower than average. It's people probably clicked out when they just felt like they weren't getting anything except I don't even know what you call that.
Just like the cost to, like, what's the cost ratio benefit or the, I'm just putting together words.
I will say this. Teaching is a great way of making a supplemental income. If you guys are going to teach, think about some of these points that we're saying and think about breaking things down. Don't just think how easy something is for you and skip steps. That's the biggest thing we see is like say a pro would come in, they're going to do a character. I'm just making this up, so this is not a real thing, but a character design demo. Okay, what am I going to start with? Okay, I'm going to start with a blank canvas, no reference, and I'm just going to scribble something. Oh, look, there's a Civil War battle scene that they see in the slop, and then they just pull that out. And like, okay, now go draw your Civil War battle scene. It's not going to go the same way. And so, you know, if I can do that as a pro, that doesn't mean that's how I'm going to try to teach my students. I'm going to say, hey, I need to draw this scene or this character, and here's some reference, and here's some other images that other people have done, and here's all the starter steps for somebody who hasn't done a million paintings and a million drawings. But it's amazing how many pros try to transition to teaching and they just skip all that stuff and be like, all right, I'm just gonna make something up, and they just bang it out, and it's impressive, but you don't learn much.
I think I've used this example before with the teacher that we had in a different company where this person was invited to teach how to write a children's book. And the instructions were, go get a bunch of books that you like and write a good book like that. That's what the video was. It was about an hour and a half of, these are the books I love. What books do you love? Go get the books you love and write a great
book. Just make that.
Just make that. And it's surprising because I don't operate that way. It's, you know what I mean? I'm like, I'm thinking, how do I, the whole time I'm designing a class, I'm thinking, how is this going to work? Am I going to be able to help someone go from not knowing how to do something to actually doing something?
And that's why I loved always like team teaching with you, Will, because you'd call me out on stuff. You're like, now hold up, how did you do that, Jake?
Yeah, you just added a flourish that became a city.
And I learned a lot about how to teach just from that. Like, they don't know how I did that and all the thought process that went behind that. Let me explain that. And it just improved my abilities overall since then.
Well, thanks. Yeah. That's coming from someone who was frustrated in school a lot. And so I remember feeling like, well, now hold on. You can't just skip over that. How did you do that?
Yeah. I was lucky because I started art so late that when I was learning the stuff at Art Center, it was a lot of times the first time I'd ever seen that information before. And so I had to stop the teachers in their tracks. I'm like, I have no idea what you're saying right now, and back them up and question them because I didn't understand, you know? So that's one of the benefits of coming late.
Cool.
Okay.
All right. What's the next one?
Number 8, starting a company is expensive. Know your margins. And kind of a subhead on this is you get to keep a tiny fraction of what your company makes each year. When we started out, the first class that Jake and I did together was just, SVS wasn't even a thought process at that time. It was basically SVS was, well, it wasn't SVS. It was just, we wanted to make a class. So we made a children's book class. We sold 20 seats. We earned a certain amount of money, or we raised a certain amount of money, and we basically split that in half. We had a $25 Dropbox fee out of that or something like that, but there were virtually no expenses at all.
Right.
And then when we started SVS, all of a sudden the amount of the percentage of the money that we actually get to keep went way down. And as an art, I'll speak for myself as an artist. It was always disappointing because it's like, man, it seems like we're doing really well.
Right. On paper.
You know, on
if
paper.
You just look at the income side of things, but right. So if people aren't familiar with that term, the margin is the difference between your expenses and your profit or your income. And that would be your profit that's left over. And it pays to know what those are. A lot of people's Kickstarters get thwarted from that little mathematical formula right there. They see I made $20,000 on a Kickstarter or whatever. And but all the shipping costs and printing costs and the cost of the packaging and all the other stuff that you didn't think about comes into play. And so you have to really know your margin. Some businesses look great at first glance, and then all of a sudden you start deep diving into the numbers. And it pays. A lot of artists aren't really numbers people, but if you're starting a business, you have to dive into the numbers.
And to be fair, we have hired kind of a marketing guy who's working with another guy and who's also working with a couple of our people. We've hired other people. And so we're not having to be experts at everything. We're saying we're not experts. We have an accountant. Mm-hmm. We have an accounting firm. Yeah,
but every time we start making more money where it looks like, hey, this business is really doing well, we hire somebody else or we have to pay mm-hmm. another company. And right. it's growing pains that you never would see coming.
Scaling a business. Yeah.
Yeah. Scaling up a business is really, really hard. All of a sudden you have to pay for storage of goods, depending on what you're doing. If I just angle my camera over here, you can see that's it's just the prints I have on hand that are my current mm-hmm. orders in those boxes. And so it's, you know, where do you store all this stuff and order in bulk and paying your CPA and like just growing the business starting a business is easy. And I think once you're really successful, it gets a lot easier. But that middle ground is, I think, where people stumble because there's growing pains and you can sabotage yourself if you over leverage that.
Yeah. So what's the takeaway for someone who's starting something else?
Just look at all the costs involved and try to make it again. If you can share costs, that's gonna be a fantastic way. You'll depending on how you split the profits too, you'll reduce that a little bit. But you want to reduce your risk as much as possible.
Go ahead, Jake.
If you have something to say about reducing risk, finish that. Then I've got a additional
thought. Anything you can try for free. So mm-hmm. for instance, in one of the things that you've said, Jake, is, you know, don't spend money on launching a product if you can't get people excited on your social media first.
Right.
You know, yeah. to even like it for free.
Right.
You know, if you can't get 100 likes or 1,000 likes or something, then that might be your market research for free right there.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that the other thing I was going to say too is if something's working and you're getting traction, sometimes it costs money to make money. And I've invested in equipment and printers and scanners and things like that that cost a lot of money up front that I knew would make my work and my job easier down the line. And I was okay with that. It was just figuring out, okay, how many prints am I going to have to sell to pay off this printer? Does it make sense to spend that much money on a printer? So don't be afraid to spend money, but also be realistic with the money that you're going to spend.
Mm-hmm. It's actually a great point, Jake. I want to highlight that because if somebody was starting a restaurant, it would sound strange for them to say, well, I just don't want to spend any money on an oven and some stoves and pans. And, you know, right. It'd be crazy. There's no way that would work. But artists sort of do that. I ran the senior portfolio class for years at the Art Institute of Portland, and they spent, you know, $50,000 on their education and then comes time to start the business. And I'm like, okay, let's send out some postcards, get a mailing list. And it's like, $500 or $1,000 to get this thing going. And they're just balking at the price. Like they don't want to do anything. They don't want to spend anything. Like they're not behaving like a normal business. Mm. And normal businesses have costs. It's called startup costs. That's what it is. And so you've got to get product and you've got to get equipment and you got to get a place to do the the stuff, and you know that it just comes with it. So consider yourself a normal business. Don't be afraid to have those expenses, but plan for them.
Great.
Cool.
Okay. Number nine, focus on what you're best at. And the thing that I think on this one the most is that, you know, when we first started, we did offer a few classes that kind of took us into different areas. Like we offered a ZBrush class, and Jake's not a 3D guy. I'm not a 3D guy. You're not a 3D guy, Lee. And, you know, it was something that someone offered to do and they did a great job, but it didn't really fit with the mission of SVS. And we, at that time, we hadn't really identified what our mission was. And in general, this is general advice for business, is that you want to narrow down your niche really, really specific in the beginning. You can broaden from there, but you really want to offer, be really good at the one thing that you do really well and make sure that it's kind of specific. And so we've really kind of focused ourselves as being the go-to place for learning how to illustrate children's books. Mm-hmm. We are currently right now working on revising our children's book curriculum. We've been talking about that for a long time. And we had to put that on the back burner because we really had to flesh out our foundations program as support for the updated children's book curriculum, which is going to be coming in the not too distant future. But from there, you know, we've talked about possibly really doing the same thing with learning how to illustrate comic books and graphic novels. And we've dabbled in those, but we really want to be known as the go-to online resource for learning how to illustrate children's books first, and then we'll move into other areas. Do you guys have anything you want to add to that one?
No, I think that's so important. Is it's fine doing five different things at some point, but you're not going to find success and make a name for yourself starting out that way. You've got to narrow down and focus. I'm going to nail this thing, children's book illustration. I'm going to nail, comic books, or I'm going to nail editorial illustration or something like that. And then branch out from there. I think you just spread yourself too thin if you're trying to figure all that stuff out as you go. So that was that. I just want to add too, like, we kept thinking, let's just launch this children's book thing. Let's do a full curriculum. How to, you know, when someone goes through this, they can have a finished children's book that they can, you know, either publish or send to an editor or something like that. And it always kept going back to, well, they're not gonna, you know, you can't draw this thing unless you know this fundamental idea, and you can't do this thing unless you know this fundamental thing. So we're like, okay, scratch that. Let's build out the fundamentals first, and then we can always have that as something like, if you don't understand this concept, we don't have to waste time in a children's book class teaching composition or light and shadow. We can just send you back to fundamentals and say, okay, take these three classes and then come back to this, and you'll be all the better at tackling this when you get to it. So that's why we're kind of going that route with it all.
Yep. Lee?
What? what Jake said. I agree with all that.
All right, next, number 10, learn from your customers. And for me, I was thinking on this one,
didn't we already do that one?
Well, we talked about it in the forums, but one of the things that we learned was that our students were power watching a lot of our classes.
Oh, yeah.
And because of that, it didn't appear that a lot of them were learning the information. They were just kind of would put a video on and as they were drawing and just kind of listen to a class, but not really take the class. And so we kind of had to really encourage and go back in and say, look, we've included these assignments with the classes for a reason, that you're not going to really learn the principles without doing and going through the steps of, you know, failure and then figuring out why you failed and what you missed and then redoing it. And in fact, some students spend a lot of time, doing assignments over and over and over again until they get it right, which is the way to learn. But for the principal, we didn't see that early on. You know, we didn't predict that students would just power watch classes. That was we had like to learn
binging.
Yeah, they're listening while they're jogging or while they're driving, which is cool. I mean, you sort of can absorb some things, but man, without doing the work, we just didn't think that people wouldn't do the work.
Right. So the takeaway for me on this is you never really exactly know how your customer's going to use your product. Now, if you're selling a print, you know, Lee's got those prints in the background, pretty sure they're probably going to put them on a wall somewhere.
Yeah, but you never know. But still, well, no, but it all factors in. I mean, where my change what happened there was I realized that when people get weird size prints, it throws them for a loop when they have to frame them. Mm-hmm. I didn't see that. When I first started, when I was in school making images, I just make them any size. Well, I like tall, skinny, or I like a big wide format, weird, some weird thing. And then all of a sudden, if people buy a $45, $55 print, they don't want to spend $200 custom framing it to your weird size. And so all my prints and all my size, I learned all the sizes. What are the standard framing sizes? Had to change all that stuff. And then people also like to have things matted already. They don't like to... It's easy to take a mat and put it in a frame for some reason, but to take a print and then get it matted and put it in a frame was an additional step that a lot of was a barrier, I guess. And so everything you have to learn with my clients as illustration clients. I used to, when I first started out, just send the JPEG, like, here's my sketches. And I learned that when they would take those sketches into meetings, I couldn't advocate for myself because all it was is a sketch and somebody asks a question. Well, they're just looking at the sketch and then they beat up the sketch and I get all these revisions. So over time I learned that if I present my work to my clients as here's the sketches, but then also here's a write-up of what I'm trying to do. And here's the reason that I'm doing it. I even include reference pictures that I'm looking at. Is this the kind of truck you want in there? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I'm trying to advocate for myself and these PDFs that they now take in to their meetings. I'm not there, but I'm advocating for myself on paper. And all of a sudden the illustration change orders were much less and the acceptance rate was much higher. And then I got to do work that I wanted to do much more. Hmm. So, and I would have never seen that coming. No teacher ever told me that, but I had to kind of look and see how the customer's using the work and where the problems are.
I met with a multimillionaire entrepreneur one time, just kind of a fluke. He was teaching a business college at the college I was teaching at. And we found out that he offered a consulting service to students for free. And so I went up there and said, hey, can I, as a teacher, can I still get in? And he's like, yeah, whatever. Sure. So, so I met with him. And one of the things, the biggest takeaway I had, he told me a lot of things, but the biggest takeaway was he said most entrepreneurs, most business people with a product cannot get out of their own way and their own ego and their own arrogance to actually listen to their customers. Mm. He said, if you can listen to your customers' complaints and not be offended, but take it as, you know, just eat it up. Just say thank you so much and thank them for all their criticisms, even if they're rude, and implement it. Then you actually stand a chance at becoming successful. If you don't, you're done. That was his advice. Okay, number 11. Understand your specific business challenges, and so kind of one of the reasons why I put this on the list is, we've learned that running an online school from three different cities presents technology challenges all the time, you know, and we have to be prepared when we schedule a class or a podcast or any kind of a presentation that we're doing online. We have to be prepared for the fact that somebody might drop out. Somebody might have really bad internet that day, or someone might fire up a lawnmower outside of a window, or who knows what, you know? So technology challenges have been, I wouldn't say really difficult for us, but definitely a challenge that, you know.
I mean, we still barely get that stuff figured out. I mean, I've got tape holding on my microphone right now. I mean, I didn't have that problem last week. It's every single week there's some new thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was that one called? It would be
understanding your specific business challenges. So
yeah, I wanted to add that to that too. It was, I think there's a opposite of that, and that is, what is your unfair advantage and what is your unfair liability? And if you know those going into it, you're going to have a much better time doing a business, doing an illustration career, something like that.
Give me an example of those. What does that mean?
So your unfair advantage might be like, I think for it could be that you have some connections in high places that other people don't have. That could be an unfair advantage that makes it sense for you to go into business. But a liability might be you have insomnia, and so you're just tired all day, right? So you could leverage your strengths against, you know, these things that are against you, and figure out what business moves you want to make that best work for those things. And if you don't take those things into account, you're gonna fail. You know, you're gonna have struggles. Other examples of unfair advantages might be like, someone might be really good in front of a camera and can talk clearly. And for them, an option might be to have a YouTube channel. And if you're not very good at being, you know, charismatic, you're still a good artist, but you're not very charismatic, then don't do a YouTube channel, because it might do more harm than good, you know, in promoting yourself. And then liabilities could be anything from health problems to just financial situation to living accommodations to things like that. Everybody has something of both, and you just have to figure out what you can work with on both sides to help you be successful.
That's good.
Great.
All right. What's number 12? Wrap that one up.
It's never too late to have a plan. Sometimes I like to just have an awkward silence just to make Jake think, like, was that good, the last thing I
He's
said?
He's got to look up. Hey, guys.
You know what, an awkward silence? It makes me think, should I have ever started a podcast with Will Perry? Is what it makes me think. So if that's what you're wanting, you're getting it.
Okay, is it never too late to have a plan or a business plan?
You should definitely have a plan at some point. We are just
the earlier
now
the better.
That is one of the things that we have learned here, is that we, you know, a lot of our growing pains came from not having a plan. When we first started, it was just in a sense it was fun, because we were just throwing all kinds of classes up there, no planning, we had no business model, we had no income model, we had no anything. And right. I think we're probably a couple of years behind where we could have probably been had we started out with a really solid, I mean, we obviously would have just started with the foundation and built that up from the beginning. But we didn't know. We didn't know what we didn't know, I guess is how I would put that.
I would say too, don't beat yourself up for that as well. Like,
yeah.
You got to just remind yourself that you made the best decision you could have made with the knowledge and the ability that you had at the time.
Mm-hmm. And we couldn't have started with a business plan, because we weren't starting a business. We were just going to do a class.
Right.
We were starting a project. And the,
by the time I got there, though, we should have related some. Oh, that reminds me. There's something I want to add to the list. I don't know. Maybe it goes under this one.
Yeah, number 13.
If you are, and it goes along with, I guess, having a plan.
This is how to be unlucky.
If you go into a business with other people, get a contract down. I don't care if it's a poorly written one on a piece of paper that you both sign, or you all three sign, but we were good about that. And there's never been a time where we didn't understand how our business was working here. And that's one thing I think we did fantastic. I mean, we just happened to get along really well anyway. But I've had other relationships, business relationships go south, and there wasn't a contract in place, because you think, oh, they're my friend, it's going to be great. Mm-hmm. If you go into business with a friend, I don't care if it's illustration or remodeling a house or whatever, selling lemonade out front, I don't care. Get a contract, even if it's with your mom or your grandma, get a contract, because a contract is just an agreement that everybody knows the parameters of what's happening. It's not mm-hmm. a distrust. That's what everybody says. Oh, I don't want to offer make them sign a contract. They'll think I don't trust them. But really, no. It's just so everybody understands is on the same page, because you want that piece of paper.
I read our piece of paper every day, and I trust you guys more every day because I read it. No, here's the thing. I wanted to go to LegalZoom and pay $50 and get one written up that we would just sort of write up, because I'm like, we're solid. And Jake and his wife were like, no, we need to get an attorney. I'm like, that's going to be so expensive. We need it, you know. And then I asked a friend of mine who's a businessman. He's like, hire the attorney. And I was like, that wasn't what I wanted to hear, because I didn't want to spend the money. But it cost us about $5,000.
Oh, God.
To get our operating agreement. Yeah.
I had a better agreement on a napkin.
But the other thing is once you have that agreement, don't lose it.
Yeah.
Have it in a place you can, where you can go back and...
Well,
and,
I'll give you an example. I mean, you don't think about all the... until you sit down and start really planning out things. I'll give you a small timing example. When I had another illustrator renting half of my studio space. So I had a home studio, and I had another illustrator in the studio. That was David Hone, who became a teacher for SBS, and he and I are great friends. We sat down and wrote a contract, and at first I was like, oh, this seems goofy. You're going to pay this much and you come in, but I just wanted him there anyway, just because he's fun to have around. Well, what if my house floods and all his equipment gets destroyed? Who's on the hook for that, him or me? And I was like, oh, I don't know. I don't know how that works. And then there's a whole host of examples that we came up with where, am I responsible? Or are you responsible? What happens then? And it was fantastic to go through that, because I mean, he's very business minded too and comfortable with that. So it was great going through that. But I guarantee if you sit down with somebody and start talking about the business and come up with some just disaster scenarios, you're going to want to have something in place.
Yep. And that's why having a lawyer is good, because they have seen they've either seen it firsthand or have heard about it or read about it, every possible ability. They're just like walking anxiety, corpses. I don't know. I'm sorry. I'm being mean. They're like these anxiety zombies that just know exactly what could possibly happen, which is good.
But then, I mean, stuff does happen. Like that tree that landed on my studio. You guys remember that?
Oh, yeah. Gnarly. David had to pay for that?
I made David pay for the whole thing. It's his fault. Oh, stuff happens, though. You know, you never know.
Yeah. Well, is that it for this episode?
That's pretty much it. I mean, we had a bonus one on there. An anecdote. Maybe we can end on that. We learned not to call at a school unless we're accredited based on someone else's warning that they called their online tutorial site a school. And I believe it was the state of Michigan that told them they had to change their name. So they had the .com with something school.
Oh, just the word school.
The word school can't in the state of Michigan, at least, couldn't be used unless you're accredited.
We should also follow that up with, you know, we get a lot of questions about people asking, are we ever going to be accredited? I would say not on your life do I want us to be accredited. Way. Once something gets accredited, it's over. It sucks.
Yeah. Well, number one, there's so much more overhead and work that goes into making sure each class follows, you know, certain guidelines. That is something that, you know, we don't pass the savings on to our customers. We have to pass those expenses on somehow, right? So it would make it more expensive. And at the end of the day, we let the classes speak for themselves. We let our students, you know, promote the classes once they've gone through it. Their portfolios speak for themselves. And ultimately, that's what matters, is your portfolio. When you go out into the world, people are going to look first to see, can you get the job done? And maybe second, maybe third or fourth is, oh, do you have an actual slip of paper that says you graduated from somewhere? They want to know, can you do the work? Are you easy to get along with? And are you on time? Are you going to deliver on time? And they'll take two of those. Right. They can get all three, they'll be happy. But if they can get two of those, they'll be delighted. That's what gets people hired.
Okay.
All right, take us out.
That's it.
All right, everybody. Thank you for joining us. 3-Point Perspective is made possible by svslearn.com. We're becoming a great illustrator starts, and your hosts have been Will Terry, Jake Parker, and Lee White. Will Terry, go to his website. It's willterry.com. You can check out his cool art there. You can also follow him on Instagram. It's at Will Terry Art. Lee White can be found at leewhiteillustration.com, and his Instagram handle is at Lee White Illo. I'm Jake Parker. My website is mrjakeparker.com. Instagram is at Jake Parker. And this podcast is produced by Aaron Painter. Go to his website at painterdraws.com. You can also follow him on Instagram. It's at painterdraws. Podcast is edited by Alex Sugg. That's Sugg with two G's. And his website is alexsugg.com. And our video for YouTube is edited by Daniel Tu. And you can find his work at daniel2.co, and that's two spelled with a T and a U. And lastly, our social media expert and community liaison, I guess, everything that is shared online is done by Lisa Fott, and special thanks goes out to her for that. All right, so if you like this episode, we'd love to hear what you think about it. We have a, in the forum, in the svslearn.com forums, we have a thread devoted just to this episode, and we'd love to have you chime in there and let us know what you think, anything you took away from it that we didn't point out, or things we maybe got wrong and could have done better. We'd love to hear that. We also would like it if you subscribe to this podcast. If this is your first time listening, we'd love it if you liked anything from this. There's more of this, 50 other episodes of stuff like this, and 50 more to come of stuff like this. So subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever there is that you can do podcasts. And if you get a chance, give us a review. 5 stars would be great. We'll take a 4-star. No 3 stars or below.
No 4 stars.
Okay. All right. That's it. We'll see you guys next time.